Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's president launches a 10-year development plan.
As we speak, I have well over 500 messages on my phone requesting that I run each family for them as president. A country will never develop with that kind of spirit.
Dozens of Kenyan schools are closed due to student arson. We'll talk with an analyst about the historic losses suffered by South Africa's ANC in last week's local government election. Compensation for Uganda's Benin people. Cameroon separatists are accused of kidnappings and torture. And a Sudan court says the government must lift the ban on the internet.
This is an illegal procedure and it violates human rights. It has caused a lot of damage to institutions, entities, and individuals.
And producing and licensing medicines and medical products in Africa, those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, has launched a 10-year national development plan aimed at alleviating poverty. The launch is the first step in the implementation of the Malawi Vision 2063, which was launched in January this year, and which seeks to make Malawi a wealthy and self-reliant nation within the next 42 years. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In his televised address, Chakwera said the country can rid itself of poverty if Malawians stop what he calls retrogressive and infectious habits.
And one infectious habit we must each cure ourselves of is the habit of demanding more from our politicians than we demand from ourselves. This 10-year implementation plan, it is not just a document of what needs to be done by a president, or the vice president, or the parliamentarians. It is a plan of action for all of us.
Chakwera said it is concerning that up to now, some Malawians believe the president can solve their family problems.
As we speak, I have well over 500 messages on my phone requesting that I run each family for them as president. And I'm not kidding. Members of Parliament, they have messages so they can run families of their constituents. A country will never develop with that kind of spirit.
Among the key goals for the first 10 years of the Malawi 2063 strategy is to reach a capital income of $1,000 per family within the next 9 years. Currently, Malawi's capital income is ranked around $600, one of the lowest in the world. Bechani Cheleni is a lecturer in economics at Malawi University of Business and Applied Sciences. He says Malawi needs to add some enforcement measures to help the country meet its aspirations.
Maybe we needed to put in place some sort of a law, an act of parliament, maybe a one-pager or a two-pager. That clearly indicated that if there's some private sector organization or indeed anybody who's starting an organization or indeed a public institution who is going to do things without following the dictates of the vision and the implementation plan, there should have been a way to have them punished.
Sherif Kais is a lecturer in political science at Blantyre International University. He says the plan would be achieved if only people put the country's interests ahead of narrow or selfish political ones.
There is only one thing here, to put the nation first and leave the political affiliation behind, because in many cases, government plans are being changed and not even taken into being because of frustrations which always are there from different political circles. For example, if the plan is being done by the current government, you will see that it can never be realized unless all stakeholders come together in a collective effort.
Malawi launched the Vision 2063 strategy in January as a follow-up to the Malawi Vision 2020 plan created in 1998, which critics believe did not realize its main goal of alleviating poverty. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
In Sudan, a court has ruled that the military government must restore internet services. Sudanese human rights activists and media practitioners say the decision to shut down the internet was illegal and violates the rights of the Sudanese people. Some citizens say the lack of internet services has affected their lives and caused them economic losses. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
On Tuesday, the Khartoum District Court ruled that internet services cut off since October 25th coup must be restored. However, it appears much of the country remains offline. The head of Sudan's military, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, ordered the telecommunications ministry to immediately shut down the internet service on October 25th, shortly before he dissolved the cabinet and suspended the constitutional declaration that set up the transitional government. Sudanese human rights activists say the decision has affected the lives of citizens and caused them social and economic damage. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus, a Sudanese lawyer and human rights activist who identified himself only as Mujahid says many Sudanese citizens do not know their rights.
This is an illegal procedure and it violates human rights. It has caused a lot of damage to institutions, entities, and individuals. The military is supposed to reverse this decision and allow people to get their services back.
Mujahid says thousands of Sudanese families have been unable to communicate with their loved ones inside and outside the country because of the internet shutdown. Khalid Al-Nur, editor-in-chief of online news outlet Sudan Press, says the decision has affected his organization's work and caused his group economic losses. Al-Nur says the military leaders should exempt media houses from the internet shutdown and allow them publish information about the situation in the country. He argues that the electronic media outlets have been reliable and faster in reaching viewers, but now they are unable to do so.
The electronic media in Sudan has been on the rise and has been winning the trust of the Sudanese viewers. If you compare it to the traditional newspaper, you will find that the electronic media have a lot of followers and they're able to access the platforms at their convenience.
Sudan's military leaders accuse some electronic and social media organizations of inciting violence and promoting hate speech. But Al-Nur insists journalists have remained professional.
We as electronic press have been observing ethics, truth, and high professionalism in our work. The government is supposed to differentiate between social media and electronic media. Our staff and journalists are professionally trained and are conducting themselves with high integrity.
Hiba Osman manages a wholesale center in the Arkawit neighborhoods in Khartoum. She sells clothes and variety of products for women and posts her goods on social media. Speaking in Arabic, Usman says for over 2 weeks now, she has been unable to sell anything, saying the loss is huge for her business. Usman says, we are no longer accessing our customers and no one can know about our items. So we are now stranded. She says, normally, when a customer requests an item online, we send them through a vehicle or motorcycle that help in delivering the items, Osman says. Osman calls on the military leaders to restore the internet service so traders can continue their business. For VOA News, I'm Michael Atit in Khartoum.
An estimated 35 schools across Kenya have been set on fire in the last month, forcing many to shut down. Authorities say the fires are being set by students and warned that any student caught in an act of arson will be locked out of the education system. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
The wave of arson began about a month ago and has gotten increasingly worse. On Sunday alone, five schools were banned. In one incident, a girls' boarding school in Nairobi caught fire in the middle of the night. 63 students needed medical attention. The Kenyan government has issued a strong warning against students who are banning schools and authorities are making arrests. On Tuesday, six students were arrested following a banning of a high school in Western Kenya. A total of 11 were arraigned in court on charges of attempted arson in Nyeri County. Visiting a school in eastern Kenya, Education Minister George Magoha said the parents and students will rebuild the affected schools. He said those found to have participated in the arson will be banned from attending public schools.
Anybody who is planning to burn the building, just remember that if you are caught, you are not going to go to any other school, definitely not a public school in this country. You will go back and ensure that your parents contribute to the rebuilding of the school that you have burned.
Officials are blaming drug abuse, stress, curriculum overload, and poor student-teacher relations for the unrest. Sam Dunda is Secretary General of the Kenya National Association of Parents. He says teachers are not properly dealing with discipline cases.
There are a number of students who have already been sent out of school in form of suspension. These students have been kept out of schools for quite a long time. Now, these students who are out there feel so bitter that our colleagues in the schools are learning, whereas we have been given an indefinite suspension. And therefore, so that they can also feel the pinch that we are feeling, then they come up and organize for this kind of fire.
Tomkins Baraza is a boarding school teacher. He says the school calendar is short and a lot of learning is expected from the students, which have made some unhappy with their studies.
These learners, maybe they fear exams. And remember, second term is when most of the schools, the candidates normally sit for mock exams. Also, the pressure which is mounted on those learners. You know, they're supposed to cover a wide syllabus within the shortest time possible. So maybe learners feel that there's a lot of academic work which is being pushed on their side.
Since the outbreak of coronavirus in March 2020, schools were closed for several months until late last year. The education systems in the country have been putting more pressure on teachers and students to recover the time lost. Some experts are pushing for open forums in schools where teachers and students can discuss their issues before students feel the need to take drastic and destructive measures. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 10th. South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress, saw historic losses in last week's municipal elections. Both citizens and political analysts said the results reflect years of broken promises and poor service delivery. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
Johannes Turner has been waiting 25 years for a new house from the South African government. Over that time, several promises that he could finally move his wife and two grandchildren never materialized. Instead, he says the country's ruling party, the African National Congress, or the ANC, allowed social housing along with other services to crumble. Which is why Turner says the party that brought the country freedom from apartheid lost his vote in last week's municipal election.
That's how we live here in this place in Cape Town. Now we suffer through the empty promises they make for us. We can talk about corruption and so on and so on and so on and so on. But that's a problem. No, you can't vote for a corrupt party.
That's the overwhelming message South Africans sent to the ANC last week. For the first time since coming to power in 1994, the party received less than half of the popular vote. The results come on the heels of record unemployment and a national inquiry into graft that indicated millions of dollars have vanished from the state coffers. President Cyril Ramaphosa has vowed to eliminate corruption, but opposition parties like the New Action SA say bigger changes are needed. Herman Mashaba is the leader of Action SA.
We've got to get rid of all ANC cadres in senior positions in government. Invite all South Africans, black and white. Let us put in professional people to run government. Make sure that those who steal a cent of public monies, put them behind bars.
Action SA saw major gains in several municipalities, including Johannesburg, where it became the third largest party with 17% of seats. More established opposition groups like the Democratic Alliance and the Economic Freedom Fighters also saw gains across the country, although not as significant as they hoped. The political scales have not tipped in any one direction. No party won a majority in 66 municipalities, including Johannesburg, requiring coalition governments to be formed. Roland Henwood is a political scientist at the University of Pretoria.
Unfortunately, what we've seen in South Africa up to now is coalition government centered around the interests of political leaders, individuals, or elites. We have not seen coalition governments around values, policy, and delivering services to people.
Forming coalitions isn't the only challenge ahead for local governments. Once in place, they need to learn how to regain public trust in politics. Roughly 60% of eligible voters were registered in the recent election, and of them, only 45% cast a ballot. Henwood says the poor turnout reflects widespread disillusionment.
It is probably time that in South Africa, the basic questions are again asked and addressed. And those are, what kind of society do we want to live in? What kind of government do you want to be if you are in politics? And are you willing to make the decisions, choices, sacrifices to achieve that?
The ANC has said it hears the public's disappointment in the party loud and clear and is determined to do better. Meanwhile, opposition parties are hopeful they can win even greater support. They have 3 years to prove themselves worthy before the next national elections. Linda Givdash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A report by Amnesty International documents several violent forced evictions in Uganda of the Bened indigenous people. Affected members of the community narrate details of the eviction from their ancestral land, saying it took place without notice, and they are asking the Ugandan government to compensate them. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Men, women, and children from Eastern Congo are being registered and assessed at the Kisoro District Transit Center. 22-year-old Anja Nema, speaking to VOA by phone, says her village of Kibaya was rocked by gunfire and this forced them to flee. She says she and others had a very rough journey. She says they suffered going on foot and having to run with their belongings, getting exhausted. She says they could not find a place to sleep and had to sleep out in the cold. It was intense, she says. Fighting is reported between armed groups in the areas of Shanzu and Runyonyi near Congo's Virunga Mountains, leading to the exodus. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says the fighting has forced 11,000 people to flee into Uganda since late Sunday. Kisoro District Red Cross branch manager Natkunda Primrose says many of the refugees slept at the border because there were no vehicles to transport them to a school facility that is being used as a transit center in the town of Nyakabande.
They are tired and most of them were coming in with just maybe a mat, a mattress, and maybe their animals like the sheep, the goats. They need support and I don't think they've even had anything to eat.
Rukundo Manase, the Kisoro District Disaster Management Committee chairperson, calls the situation at the border alarming. Rukundo says the refugees need protective gear, medicine, food, water and washing facilities. He also says they need tracing services, especially for misplaced children.
That number is a bit abnormal. We have never handled such big numbers before. What we are working on is closely with the UNHCR to see if they can come in quickly and for those who are willing to move to camps and they are picked away.
UNHCR says together with the Ugandan government, they have so far relocated about 500 asylum seekers to the Nyakabande Transit Center, which can accommodate up to 1,500 people. UNHCR officials are concerned that the local capacity and services may be soon overwhelmed and request urgent resources to address the needs of the new arrivals. The agency says so far this year, it has received only 45% of the funding for its operations in Uganda, a country that hosts some 1.4 million refugees, more than any other in Africa. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Cameroon military officials say separatists have abducted and tortured several hundred civilians that they accuse of violating a lockdown that the fighters have imposed in the English-speaking western regions every Monday. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, where there has been renewed condemnation of human rights abuses by separatists.
These are the voices of Cameroonians crying for help and begging for their lives to be spared. In the audio from a video circulating on social media platforms such as Facebook and WhatsApp, armed men appear to order 17 people out of a bus. The armed men brandish AK-47 rifles and threaten to kill anyone who disobeys their orders. Among the 17 people are four women carrying babies. English-speaking separatists on social media say they took and shared the video. Cameroon military confirms it was taken by separatists in the southwest region. The armed men then forced all the occupants of the bus to lie down before beating them with sticks and machetes for more than 10 minutes. In the video, a man presenting himself as a fighter says his group is punishing civilians who do not respect the Monday lockdown imposed by separatists in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. Cameroon military officials say the attack was carried out by fighters on people traveling between Boya and Kumba, both commercial cities in the English-speaking southwest region. Military officials say similar attacks and abductions by fighters were reported in several other English-speaking towns, including Mamfi, Ekona, and Tiko. Officials also said an improvised explosive device planted by the fighters killed a taxi driver in Boya. Last week, separatists said on social media they killed four people who collaborated with government troops to kill a man known as Cross and Die, one of the fighters' self-proclaimed generals. Military officials confirmed troops had killed Cross and Die. One separatist armed group known as the Ambazonia Defense Forces ADF, also on social media, said it carried out many attacks and abductions on hundreds of civilians in several towns for disrespecting the Monday lockdown ordered by separatists. 37-year-old cocoa seller Didymus Epier says he was abducted in Ekona. He says his abductors accused him of disobeying orders by separatists that no one should be seen in public places on Mondays. Epier spoke via telephone from Ekona.
The environment is quite hostile, and we're just praying that one day the situation should get better, but for now, it's really bad. On a daily basis, when we go about our duty, we expose ourselves to grave danger.
APS said he paid a $500 ransom to secure his release from a separatist camp in a bush. Bernard Okalia Bilai is governor of the Southwest region. He says civilians should not respect calls by separatists to keep their businesses sealed on Mondays. He spoke via telephone from Boya, the capital of the Southwest region.
I expect everyone to support by denouncing any form of disturbances or disorder that they notice in their community. People should not hesitate to contact their local administrative authorities, sources of law and order, or any other dignity in their community to denounce any strange persons. So we must continue to remain vigilant.
Bilai said the military has been instructed to protect civilians and their businesses from fighters who want economic activity grounded on Mondays. Separatists have imposed a lockdown of economic activity in the English-speaking region on Mondays since 2017 as a sign they control the territory. Violence erupted in 2017 in Cameroon's English-speaking regions when teachers and lawyers protested alleged discrimination at the hands of the French-speaking majority. The military reacted with a crackdown, and separatist groups took up weapons, claiming that they were acting to protect civilians. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that's it for this Wednesday, November 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol approved six more subpoenas targeting top campaign aides to then-President Trump and others involved in the effort to overturn the 2020 election. This and lots more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.